Chris Boyd. Up next on Think, democracy is good for a lot of things, but it doesn't guarantee robust economic growth, at least not as practiced in the United States. We'll spend the hour with economist Dambisa Moyo, who says growth is essential to national and global stability, but that U.S. economic policy is warped by uninformed, apathetic voters, catered to by politicians who only set their sights as far as the next election. We'll talk about how Western liberal democracy has fallen short, why trade protectionism and isolationism will not fix what ails us, and what can be done to make up for the effect of jobs lost to technology. Our conversation starts after a short break. For a long time, economic vitality was a sort of fringe benefit of Western-style liberal democracy. Countries with freely elected governments enjoyed long stretches of robust growth, which in turn delivered domestic and international stability. So what are we to make of China's long run of growing prosperity in light of rising American debt and income inequality? From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. Economist Dambisa Moyo is a regular contributor to The Wall Street Journal and The Financial Times. She says if democracy is to continue delivering the economic growth we need to remain stable and powerful, it's time to consider changing the way we practice it, including some radical-sounding amendments to the rights and responsibilities of registered voters. Her new book is called Edge of Chaos: Why Democracy is Failing to Deliver Economic Growth and How to Fix It. She joins us from the studios of KQED in San Francisco to talk about it. Dambisa, welcome to Think.
Thank you for having me. Thank you very much.
For a long time, capitalist democracies enjoyed strong and fairly predictable economic growth. What is it about democracy that under ideal conditions primes the society for economic prosperity?
The most important things that come out of a stable, predictable political system are threefold. One is that you end up with better economic outcomes. We've seen long-term economic growth in a sustained way be really the story of Western civilization over many several decades. Another point is that it is the backdrop of innovation. So it's no surprise that the United States continues to be a hub or a big driver of the most important innovations around the world. But critically, as a third point, is that the confluence of economic growth as well as politics, democratic politics, means that you have a much more engaged middle class that's able to practice a more liberal, engaged political system, which I believe is the backdrop for the economic success and human progress that we all seek.
You also note that growth allows for ongoing infrastructure investment, which helps deliver more growth down the line.
That's exactly right, which is deeply concerning given that the United States infrastructure is rated a D+ according to the American Civil Engineering Society report. We do know that any modern society needs functioning roads and railways, bridges and tunnels. But look around the United States, the major airports and other infrastructure, and they are quite dilapidated. And against that backdrop, there are real concerns about the ability to support trade and commerce and the movement of goods and services becomes much more hampered.
Is government debt a hindrance to private sector economic growth?
Yes, it is. There are only a handful of ways that we can resolve government debt, but debt in general. You need to be concerned about issues around inflating the debt away or even outright defaults. And there's a lot of historical context that shows that under significant pressure, even reserve currencies, countries that have reserve currencies like the United States is today, could be subjected to pressures to default on their debt. I'm hoping that we're nowhere near that precipice, but there is another element which does help to drive reduction in concerns around debt, and that is economic growth. However, the broad economic malaise of slow and low growth does make it much more challenging to pay back debt, particularly in a rising interest rate environment.
I want to go back to what you said earlier about the fact that a functional democracy needs a strong middle class that's capable of holding political leaders accountable. Why is this a job for the middle class, and how does that work?
Well, really, it's about voter participation and voter engagement. If we have a middle class, a critical mass of a middle class, they're more easily able to participate in the voting process. They're more easily able to have satiated their basic human conditions in terms of shelter, food, access to education and healthcare, and therefore have the ability and bandwidth to participate in the voting and the electoral process. In the United States, the average voter participation rate is around 50%. We know that for families who are low income and low income households, where per capita income is about $30,000, the voter participation rate is less than 30%. And that really is really about people's inability to participate in the political process, largely because it's too expensive, particularly for minimum wage workers, to take time off to go and stand in a line, very long lines, to participate in the political process. So we do need a middle class to hold government accountable and to ensure that government is actually doing exactly what they're supposed to be doing.
Well, to make what may be the world's most obvious statement, the U.S. economy currently works much better for some individuals than for others. Why have we seen economic inequality increasing in recent decades in the U.S.?
Well, a large part of it is that you're right that there is a schism that has emerged and money has seeped into the political process. According to a New York Times report, just 158 families in this country were responsible for 50% of the political contributions in the 2016 presidential elections. But there's a bigger issue around income inequality, deep concerns around social mobility. Some estimates suggest that social mobility in this country has halved. It's gone down by 50% over the last several decades. That's basically the probability that you would be born in a low-income household and then end up in a high-income household has gone down by 50%. And that is a really a important piece of solving income inequality. But beyond that, we know that a lot of the gains from globalization and economic progress have actually accrued to people who own capital, so the investors and people who have money, as opposed to the worker, the people who are providing labor. We know real wages declined over many, many decades. And it's that sort of economic malaise that has actually contributed to the widening of income inequality.
And then does income inequality in turn hurt growth?
Well, it certainly does, because I think that we've seen over multiple decades of analysis. In fact, there's a fantastic book by Walter Scheidel, who's a professor at Stanford. His book is called The Great Leveler. He talks about how many episodes over thousands of years of income inequality have tended to be resolved by political instability, so revolutions, civil unrest, etc. And we know right now that one of the biggest challenges for public policymakers is that we have tried two extremes to solve the income inequality challenge without much progress. We've tried to tax and redistribute, which is very favored by left-leaning parties, very favored in Europe. That has not stemmed the widening of income inequality. We have also tried more right-leaning policies, which are more trickle-down, keep tax rates low, and try to encourage job creation and improve wages. But that has also, over several decades, not stemmed the tide of widening income inequality. So we are at a crossroads. And obviously, any type of political instability does seep into and hurt economic growth.
So the president has been eager to protect U.S. interests with protectionist trade policies, the America First idea. It makes sense to people who think, yeah, maybe we're losing because we've been too generous in international deals, too tolerant of policies that don't look out exclusively for American interests. What's your sense of whether this is a remedy to slow growth?
Well, I think there are two critical points worth making. First of all, I think that trade agreements should not be static. They should be, like everything else, should be subject to improvements and should be revisited. And so I'm not exactly offended or concerned about revisiting questions around NAFTA. Having said that, or by the way, more generally, looking at coming up with better engagement or better analysis of trade agreements around the world. I think that that's what good governments and good governance should do anyway. But having said that, we do have a history of, and we know historically that protectionist policies, higher tariffs, higher quotas have always been have led to bad outcomes. Go back to the 1930s on the back of just in the aftermath of the Great Depression, we had the Smoot-Hawley tariffs. This is when the United States government imposed tariffs for over 3,200 goods. I think it's consensus amongst economists and historians that led to a slowdown in America's recovery from the Great Depression, but it also increased unemployment, and it certainly it delayed the increase in economic growth. And so there are many examples around the world, but certainly here in the United States, examples that these types of protectionist policies may be short-term appealing, but longer-term have very very significant dire consequences.
You do think U.S. presidents should have more latitude to forge economic treaties, and I gather by what you're saying also to adjust them according to conditions as they change. Is that right?
I do, but I also recognize that, and one of the proposals in my book is that we do need to bind governments as well. It does take a considerable amount of time and effort and analysis and reflection to change public policy. And we don't want to live in a world where there's so much time inconsistency, meaning that a president puts in certain policies today and then, the very next clip, a year later, those policies are somewhat easily unwound, either by executive order or some other form of challenge. I think that having some grandfathering of public policy actually helps to provide investors and companies and other household considerations with some understanding that that policy will not be changing and moving around. And so I very much favor binding the government to certain policies for some time. But nevertheless, I do believe in innovation. And so I do think that we should have some sense of revisiting policies and reassessing them for the prevailing times.
So for a lot of modern history, Dambisa, new technologies ultimately meant a gain in jobs, right? As new industries sprang up around these exciting developments and productivity grew. Have we reached the end of that era?
Well, there are a lot of data points that are quite worrying. As you're aware, at the turn of the last century, 1900, 60% of Americans were involved in agriculture. Today, less than 2% of the American workforce is involved in agriculture. But we know what happened. We know that people moved out of agriculture into manufacturing and from manufacturing into the service sector. So today, about 80% of Americans are involved in the service sector. The challenge for public policy today is that we don't have a large, obvious sector that could absorb not just lowly skilled workers, but increasingly skilled workers who don't have the technical expertise to compete in a gig economy. And that is why it's deeply concerning, because not only do we have a situation where, according to the International Labor Organization, 100 million young people between the ages of 18 and 25 are out of work, but we also have a situation where, according to the OECD, this generation of Americans, for the first time in the history of this country, will be less educated than the preceding generation. And so there are real concerns about making sure that we have not just the job opportunities, but also the skill set to be able to compete in the world to come. So I do remain pretty optimistic about what technology can do in terms of enhancing our lives. And of course, there is an argument that technology is making our lives, many aspects of our lives, cheaper to communicate, to travel, to produce food. But at the same time, from a public policy perspective, there are real reasons to be concerned about not being able to provide jobs if we see the disruption that we've seen in previous sectors.
Why will this next generation be less educated? Is that because of the cost of higher education these days?
A very significant contribution is absolutely the cost. I mean, you talked earlier about the question around debt. It's not just government debt. Virtually every class of debt in this country is now over $1 trillion. Auto loan debt, student loan debt, credit card debt, household debt, etc. That's incredibly burdensome for running a country. But in a world where there's slow economic growth and job opportunities are shrinking, it means that people are ending up with massive student loans and no opportunities to be able to pay them back. And so this it even shines light even more on this schism between people's skill set and the lack of job opportunities. And so debt does become a considerable problem.
So back to your central thesis in this book, how is it that American democracy lost its way to the extent that our economy isn't growing the way we need it to? I think a lot of people think of those as equally concerning problems, but maybe separate from one another.
Well, the main argument of my book, Edge of Chaos, is really about short-termism and the fact that we have many, many long-term economic challenges, many of them we've touched on, the risk of technology in the jobless underclass, concerns around debt, widening income inequality, productivity declines. Those are all long-term intergenerational problems, but we're dealing with these long-term challenges at precisely the time that liberal democratic politics is very short-term. So politicians very rationally court today's voter and try to win the next election, which in this country is every 2 years, 4 years for the presidency. But that means there's a very natural schism or mismatch between long-term economic challenges and short-termism embedded in the political process.
My guest, economist Dambisa Moyo, is a regular contributor to The Wall Street Journal and The Financial Times. Her new book is called Edge of Chaos: Why Democracy is Failing to Deliver Economic Growth and How to Fix It. We'll be back in 2 minutes. This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd, and my guest this hour is Dambisa Moyo. She's an economist who contributes to The Wall Street Journal and The Financial Times. She's got a new book out called Edge of Chaos: Why Democracy is Failing to Deliver Economic Growth and How to Fix It. All right, so let's talk about some of the ways you think we could make our democracy function better. One idea you have is to require elected leaders to demonstrate some essential skills and preparation in order to run for office. So how do we make those rules and make sure that we're not writing them for the advantage of one party or another, one candidate or another?
Well, you know, I just want to be clear. I have 10 proposals in the book on how we can improve democracy. And as you're aware, we've spent a lot of time as economists and commentators and just average citizens criticizing the Chinese model. And we all have advice for what they should do. And I thought it was really imperative that we come up with solutions for democracy, given that it is struggling at the moment. I do think that minimum standards is not something that is so antithetical to improving the political system. If you look at Britain in the 1960s, the average age for a parliamentarian was around 62 years old, and they had very broad experiences, teachers, lawyers, farmers, doctors, etc. So they came to the political process with some knowledge of how an economy functions. Today, there are many surveys that show that the average age has come down considerably. In places like Britain, the average age is around 40 years old, and many people have become professional politicians. And I think this is a grave disservice to public policymaking. And it actually does hurt us long term.
So what kinds of requirements could we at least consider?
Well, I think I just named a couple, meaning that I think that if we should place a premium on people who have got outside experience. I think this notion of having professional politicians, I think, is long-term deleterious. And so I think I do talk in the book a little bit about some of the challenges around implementation, but it's certainly as a first port of call, we need to be able to acknowledge that there's something beneficial for public policy and for society to have engineers and scientists and people from other sectors in the economy participating in the political process.
So it sounds like you're saying not so much that there are people who are in office today that we would have let them out or not allowed them to run in the first place. You're talking about just diversifying the base of people that we have seeking elected office.
Well, I think that they sort of go hand in hand. I mean, I'm not proposing at all that we sort of remove people who are currently serving. I mean, they have been elected by process. What I am suggesting is that we should be a bit more stringent on the political process, because there are significant long-term consequences for having equality of a representation that perhaps doesn't have better or thorough information around how economies work.
So a lot of Americans are really committed to the ideals of democracy, and we are outraged when we hear about a country somewhere else where people aren't allowed to exercise a right to vote. On the other hand, when our elections roll around, we don't have a great track record of showing up in really significant percentages. So how would something like compulsory voting, do you think, change American democracy?
That's a great question. It's one of the 10 proposals that I think we should consider. And again, it's worth highlighting the fact that these proposals are not for wholesale consumption. It's for debate to mm-hmm. ensure that we improve not just the legitimacy issues and that are plaguing the democratic process, but also think about these myopic challenges that I spoke about earlier. There are 27 countries in the world today that have a mandatory voting, countries like Australia and Belgium, Luxembourg and Greece, and many countries in South America as well. And perhaps unsurprisingly, the participation rates in those countries are over 90%. They are very aggressive fines and penalties for people not participating in the political process as voters. So you could face a monetary fine, actual cash fines, or you could be restricted from participating or using public services or even getting a government job. I know that very much flies in the face of sort of the First Amendment and Americans' view about the right to choose. But I think there's something quite appealing for us to really celebrate and respect the civic responsibility of participating in our future path. And so I do think it's something worth considering and worth highlighting.
What have been the benefits for those places that have installed compulsory voting or something very close to it?
Well, certainly there's the issue of legitimacy. I mean, people look at those democracies and they feel that because they're much broader participation, there is much broader participation. It signals that there's much more credibility around the outcomes. And it's probably worth just mentioning that, this proposal in particular will not necessarily change an outcome in terms of Brexit, for example, or even the election of President Trump. But it certainly would take away a lot of the issues around illegitimacy that have plagued those particular outcomes and election results. So I think that that's a very important thing. But obviously, there's a lot of speculation. What kinds of policies might be instituted if everybody voted. So I mentioned earlier that the people who are least likely to vote tend to be very poor households. You could see a situation where there's mandatory voting that where perhaps those types of voters would be inclined to vote more to the left of center and perhaps be more interested in public policy outcomes that improve their living standards, such as education and healthcare, and maybe it would be less inclined for politicians, therefore, to focus on issues that directly impact businesses, such as tax rates.
Ideally, participants in a democracy would be well-informed, would be engaged, would know what's going on. Those are not the requirements for voting in America. One needs to be a U.S. citizen, registered to vote, and 18 years old. That's all we've asked for. You think we should consider asking more of voters? Talk about that.
Yes, so it is absolutely the case already that as an immigrant to this country, you are required to take a civics test. It's not particularly difficult, but nevertheless, it does show commitment and engagement to the political process. These tests are not designed at all to focus on IQ or wealth or race or gender. I mean, we've already passed that discussion and we've acknowledged that, issues of women's suffrage and civil rights are things that a modern society embraces. So this is really about engagement, rewarding and ascribing weights to voters based on their engagement, a basic understanding of how the political process works. What's the difference between the legislature, the executive and the judiciary? How and what the rights of voters are. And so many countries are considering these types of weights. And I think that we would all benefit if voters had just a modicum of better understanding of the civic process. I think one of the most obvious ways to do this is to have civics training in high school or even in junior high so that young people do understand how and why the political process in a liberal democracy works the way it does.
As I know you're aware, we have this really troubled history in the U.S. with tests that ostensibly just want to ensure that voters understand basic civics. How could we create a civics test that is fair and impartial and doesn't harken back to the days when such tests were really designed to weed out minority voters?
Well, I'm pretty optimistic, meaning, this country is founded on and is celebrated for innovation, for doing better at every turn. And so, I'm not dissuaded in sort of improving democracy because, it hasn't worked well in the past. I think we need to be absolutely conscious and cognizant of those pitfalls. But I do think that these type of discussions are warranted and are urgent given the economic challenges that we face ahead. At some point, in history, it was considered crazy, the notion that women should be given suffrage, or that blacks and other minority groups should be allowed to vote and participate in the political process. But we've worked through that. And so in the same way, I think, you know, aspiring for more voters so we can get closer to that one man, one vote mantra, but also having more knowledgeable voters are two goals that I don't consider are so lofty that we should not at least try to pursue them.
What about giving extra voting power to people who might be considered experts in their field? How would you, I know this is just a thought exercise, but talk a little bit about how something like that could work.
Well, I think that, you know, we certainly, again, do not want to ascribe votes based on any form of adjective. So mm-hmm. I think anything that smacks of IQ or education, it tends to raise heckles. However, yeah, I would say that there is something worth discussing on whether or not some kind of knowledge or understanding of issues could be a weight that we give. And I think perhaps in a referendum situation, I mean, it happened to be in California, they have propositions all the time. I think in that type of a setting, it might be easier to implement and to think about than perhaps for general elections. But, you know, we are already in hearing in experimentation in different countries that that doctors and nurses, people who work in healthcare field, might get bigger weights to vote on issues of public policy that are focused on healthcare, because they do have more information and more of an understanding of where the marginal dollar should be spent. Should it be on x-rays? Should it be on beds? Should it be on medicine? Frankly, I don't know. I don't work in that sector. But they might actually have a bit more information that we would benefit from. Similarly with teachers and education, etc. But, you know, I think we can devise some kind of hurdles that don't exclude other people. So just because you're not a doctor, it doesn't mean that you therefore are excluded from voting in that in a healthcare debate. I think it just means that we would have to then show some knowledge, or at least some information that shows that we are quite au fait with some of those issues.
But if the vote of, say, a doctor or a teacher or whoever counts more than the vote of their next door neighbor who knows less, would we struggle with politicians pandering to constituents who are already powerful and wealthy over those who are, you know, less influential, more poorly educated, simply by virtue of where they are in the world?
Well, I'm afraid you're actually describing the current situation.
Huh. Okay,
this is exactly the situation we're trying to move away from. Mm-hmm. We do want more voters. I mean, just to be absolutely clear, what is the goal of reforming democracies? Because we want as many people who are eligible to vote to vote. So voters need to get out there and vote. But we also want to make sure that voters are somewhat knowledgeable about the issues that are on the ballot. They're much more knowledgeable about the way the political system works. I don't think that those things are bad goals. I think that there's certainly implementation challenges and things we need to think about. But as I said, this is America. We can put a man on the moon. I think we can figure out how to improve our political process.
You're listening to Think. I'm Chris Boyd. You also suggest we might take a critical look at the length of political terms. Mexico is maybe nobody's best example of the ideal democracy, but you see advantages to that single 6-year presidential term.
Yes. So I'm just, you know, going back to this schism between the long-term economic challenges that we face and the short-termism that's naturally embedded in a liberal democratic system where elections happen, in, as I mentioned, every 2 years in this country. And I think that can be quite distracting. So the proposal is to basically try and bridge that schism or that gap by extending political terms. You pick Mexico, but Brazil also has similar long-term elections, the Philippines, many other countries where the presidency or the senators have a longer electoral time to be in political office, but they also do not have to face elections in that period. In Brazil, senators are in office for 8 to 9 years. In Mexico, as you said, for the president, they get one term. It's a 6-year term that better matches business cycles, economic cycles, and you don't have to worry about fighting elections. I think there is something somewhat appealing about getting politicians, moving them away from being distracted by constantly trying to court to today's voters and getting them focused on long-term issues.
Of course, it also allows people to make decisions that would get anybody not elected again, but are important.
Well, yes. I mean, look, there are certainly downsides. But I mean, if we take a sort of step back and we think about having better quality politicians, better quality or better knowledgeable, more engaged voters, then I think that will mitigate or reduce the risk of us electing people who are focused on implementing bad policies.
How important are term limits for legislators, do you think?
I think it's quite critical. I think, like, businesses where we have annual reviews and, as workers and employees, we are subject to checks and balances and how our performance is helping to drive businesses. I think that having a politician who is in office, as we've seen in the United States with Congressman Dingell, who was in office at I believe it's almost 59 years, Senator Byrd, who was in office for over 50 years as well. I mean, I think those long terms are somewhat indistinguishable from the sorts of terms that we see in illiberal democracies or authoritarian states. Hmm. And I just wonder aloud whether that kind of malaise and sort of entrenched thinking or entrenchment that we see from having stayed politicians, whether it actually hurts public policy making in the long term. Obviously they are subject to the electoral process, but I just ask out loud as I think about improving democracy as whether these long terms are actually quite problematic.
Do you have a ballpark figure, like what would be, the maximum term that is probably healthy?
You know, I don't. I think it really depends on, what country you're in. Mm-hmm. We've talked about Mexico has 6 years. Places like Britain have a 5-year term. So I think it really depends on what the country's business cycles look like and what people's appetite is. I mean, I think having senators for 9 years in Brazil seems to be something that works for that society. But it really depends on the business cycles and I think what appetite people have for tolerating politicians without having to force them to ballot.
We do get stuck on the way we've always done things. When somebody decided on a 4-year term for president and a 2-year term for congressman and a 6-year term for senators, it wasn't like there were 9 studies performed to decide that these were the ideal terms, right? They were just sort of decided in a somewhat, I gather, arbitrary way.
Well, yes, and look, I it's not just about terms. It's also about things like voting day. It's on a Tuesday. I think that there are lots of studies that say it would help a lot of voters, in particular indigent and poorer voters, if it happened on the weekend when they didn't have to take off from jobs and sometimes minimum wage jobs where they're paid on an hourly rate. And it's those sort of small tweaks to things that have just been in place for ages that certainly worked in a certain context but may not work in today's modern society, I think can be incredibly, hugely important in improving the democratic process.
My guest, economist Dambisa Moyo, is a regular contributor to The Wall Street Journal and The Financial Times. Her new book is called Edge of Chaos: Why Democracy is Failing to Deliver Economic Growth and How to Fix It. We'll be back in 2 minutes. This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd, and my guest this hour is Dambisa Moyo. She's an economist who contributes to The Wall Street Journal and The Financial Times. She's got a new book out called Edge of Chaos: Why Democracy is Failing to Deliver Economic Growth and How to Fix It. So if you have a lot of money in this country, Dambisa, you almost by definition have access to a louder political megaphone than people who don't have very much. Is there a way to permanently change the influence private money has on political activity?
It's a fantastic question. And the disturbing thing, I would say, is that it's not just about being in this country. As you're aware, through Citizens United decision from the U.S. Supreme Court a few years ago, actually foreigners, foreign corporate entities are also able to contribute and to meet our representatives, senators and congressmen, and to engage with them on issues about finance and security. And I find that quite disturbing, so that wealthy non-Americans are in some way able to engage on public policy matters. I am pretty optimistic that there will be a continuing groundswell from the average voter, average citizen, on things that they consider to be antithetical or sort of flying in the face of moral and ethics, with ethical issues. What do I mean by that? I think that the Supreme Court decision in many ways moved us away from reforming the money issue. But I think that, like many other issues that are on the ballot these days, or certainly in the political and economic zeitgeist, issues like gun control, gun violence, even though legally there are protections for those sectors, I think that the general mood and a sort of lack of acceptance by the average citizen means that there will be a shift in the way that companies, but also politicians who represent us, think about these issues. So I am optimistic that even if we don't get significant sort of legal sort of a challenge to some of these issues around voting and campaign finance, etc., I think that more and more voters will be deeply concerned and will push back on this type of economic or money seeping into the political process.
One thing that seems to unite Americans across the political spectrum is the sense of outrage when lawmakers start talking about giving themselves a raise. You say we absolutely should consider paying them more. Explain why.
Well, I think that we should, for a couple of reasons. One is that, and by the way, just to be clear, it's to increase their pay, but also force them to justify the compensation. Mm. I think that we ought to pay them more because I think it could potentially attract higher quality workers. And of course, there's a debate as to whether we want people who are drawn only by money to go into that. But I think that there's something there. But also, I think that it would also discourage this bad smell around politicians essentially managing their careers with an eye to join corporations or to participate in the private sector once they've left office. A great example of how pay is much higher for politicians is Singapore, where the prime minister gets paid $1.7 million a year. But for me, what's much more interesting is that the ministers who represent the education department, healthcare, etc., get paid 30 to 40% bonuses based on economic outcomes. So GDP increases, inflation decreases, life expectancy improvements, etc. And more than that, they face clawbacks if they don't perform. So they'll have to give back money. And I think that we know as individuals who work in private companies that that's the kind of framework that that works and governs private sector compensation. And so I don't see why we ought to consider that, at least as we think about reforming democracy and how politicians work.
Lots of private sector industries reward their best performers with bonuses. Is that something we should think about for elected leaders?
Well, I think the Singapore model that I just described, I think, is quite intriguing. At a minimum, we should consider it. And, you know, I think that the idea of money and pay for performance and, you know, punishment for lack of performance, if I can use shorthand, I think are things that the average American really understands. This is a capitalist society. People understand money. And I think, you know, having politicians subjected to high standards of, you know, justifying their compensations, but also rewarding them for good behavior and good outcomes, I think is something that we should at least consider.
It's proven incredibly hard to change money in politics, except to keep introducing more of it, in part because with respect to our elected leaders, we have the fox guarding the hen house here. So who can make these kinds of changes?
Well, I think the average voter, you know, this country, I gave the example of gun control. But there's also other examples, issues like environmental concerns, issues like gender pay, or even just income inequality and compensation. These are all issues where there are legal, there's legal cover. But, you know, clearly individuals are saying, well, actually, you know, this is just not good enough. We want to see better improvement, and there's pushback. And I think that corporations and politicians and institutions are responding to what the average person, average citizen is saying. In a social media world, it's become even more direct. And so I'm pretty open-minded and encouraged that we will see responses from traditional institutions. But at the same time, I think we will continue to see a groundswell of opposition and encouragement from the average citizen on where we can do better.
You quote in the book a Pew Research study that finds that since 1992, 93% of House members who seek re-election have won. Now, it could be, Dambisa, that we all, you know, districts all over the country just choose right the first time, or it could be that there is an unfair advantage that comes with being an incumbent candidate. So what do we do about that?
Well, you know, the risk is that you end up with a sort of rotten borough mm-hmm. kind of thing that we've seen, and we saw in Britain and centuries gone. And I think that that's where more aggressive interventions might come into play. So I'll give you a couple of examples from other countries. In Britain, again, I'll give Britain as an example. You're not allowed to use as much money as you wish for media campaigns and political campaigns. Political campaigns for all parties at a certain threshold are paid for by the government, by the public purse, and it's capped depending on, you know, how much you spend on an ad. In this country, I think that people are favored by their ability to access and to tap into certain pockets of wealth. And I think that it goes back to the discussion we had earlier around wealth seeping into the political process. I think that's an example of where we can do much better.
And talk a little bit about the ways that electoral maps could be changed. You know, as it is now, you typically have one party or the other in control of redrawing things. Is it like humanly possible to put together a nonpartisan committee to look at the districts and how they're drawn?
Well, again, I'm an eternal optimist, and I do talk about the gerrymandering and borders in the book. I think that there is scope for us to do sort of a cross-party type of engagement. I know that people might find some of these proposals to be sort of high hurdles to clear, but, you know, as I've said earlier, you know, this country is known for innovation when things get tough or bad, and I think that we do need to be open-minded about how we can reform things in a very constructive way. And so I think across the aisle, sort of cross-party initiatives on how to think about redistricting and redrawing the voting lines, I think is something that is good for public policy. It's good for outcomes, and I think it's something we should definitely consider.
So there is, a modicum of civics education that happens within the public school system, I imagine in most private school systems as well. We are supposed to be taught these things as we're growing up. There's also a lot of bad information that circulates through sometimes through the traditional media and sometimes through these sort of alternative channels that exist to disseminate bad information. Can we do anything about people spreading misinformation about politics, candidates, the state of the country without infringing on First Amendment rights?
Well, it's a fantastic question. I think that one of the articles that I published recently looks at whether or not we could have some kind of Glass-Steagall regulation for media. So Glass-Steagall regulation is the regulation that governs financial institutions and has separated commercial retail banking from investment banking or trading businesses. And I just wonder aloud whether or not we could have that kind of thinking around what is considered fact versus opinion, having some kind of a regulatory body that where you have to actually, first of all, you're described as a publisher, especially for social media in the world that we're living in right now. But more specifically, you separate any commentary that is actually accepted as being fact and verifiable versus people's opinions, which is where I think we've gotten into a bit of trouble. Obviously, with social media sites, There's been real concern in recent years about what that means for echo chambers, so people basically staying in their little area and reinforcing and their biases and their own sense of what the interpretation of the economy and the world is. But there's also real concerns around the anonymity of many people and participants in social media, which has led us to obviously many of the concerns that we have around the political system today. So I'm pretty optimistic that we will see some reforms, and many of those reforms might come from high in terms of regulatory stepping in. But I think also many businesses are recognizing that they need to do more to protect our democracy and to protect engagement. And maybe we'll hark back to the Walter Cronkite type of era where we can all, whether you're left or right leaning, and regardless of your race, origin, gender, or age, can look at somebody or look at something and all acknowledge that is fact.
You're listening to Think. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest, economist Dambisa Moyo, is a regular contributor to The Wall Street Journal and The Financial Times. Her new book is called Edge of Chaos: Why Democracy is Failing to Deliver Economic Growth and How to Fix It.
I realize you're an economist by training and not a demographer, but I wonder if you just have a sense, having thought deeply about a lot of these things, as to why young people don't more actively engage early in their young adult lives in being active politically by voting.
Well, as somebody who was young once, I think it has to do a lot with, just a learning process. And I think, to the extent that we as older people don't seem to show young people that this is an important right, it's critical for us to be good citizens and to participate as a civic responsibility, participate in the political process, I think we're setting a bad example. There are lots of studies. There's a study in the Netherlands that used to have mandatory voting. They got rid of it. And not only did the average participation rate plummet, but we saw even more significant reductions in the number of participation rate for young people. I think that those type of trends are very disturbing. I do hope that young people will become more engaged. I think that they will. We've seen them come out for different candidates, different things that are resonating with them. We just need to figure out how to keep them engaged for much longer.
Is there an ideal rate of economic growth in sort of average years for an established industrialized democracy like the United States? Is there a number that you can give us?
Well, so the number's worth thinking about. So, a country needs to grow at 7% per year in order to double per capita incomes in one generation. So that is really the great target rate. If we can grow at 7% a year over one generation, so-called 25 years, we'll be able to double per capita incomes. Now, you could make the case that, an economy like the United States growing at 2.5-3% is actually doing pretty well because, the average citizen is actually living at a certain per capita level of income. And, if you go back historically, growth rates were essentially zero. So the fact that we're producing a 2% growth rate is actually something that we shouldn't balk at. But we do live in a world where we are focused on GDP numbers, we are focused on growth numbers. I think there are a lot of questions about the efficacy of those numbers and whether they really are reflecting the full costs that growth and GDP, the pursuit of growth might bring. So things like the ecological damage and et cetera that have become very much to the fore. But those are really the numbers and the parameters that people think about as economists.
Economist Dambisa Moyo is a regular contributor to The Wall Street Journal and The Financial Times. Her new book is called Edge of Chaos: Why Democracy is Failing to Deliver Economic Growth and How to Fix It. Dambisa, thank you so much for spending this time with us.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you for having me. I really appreciate it.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker. Shelley Canavy is technical director. Samantha Guzman is associate producer. Jeff Whittington is executive producer. Our Twitter handle is @KERAThink. You can subscribe to the podcast and learn all about the show at our website, think.kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.